is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We welcome with us this morning the Paralegal Club of Northwest Technical College in De Pere. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning to listen to our arguments. You may be seated. Have you received information about our case that you're about to hear? Good. Well, we've met you, but let me introduce the court to you all. I will start on the far right, and that's Justice David Prosser, and seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With our Court with Class program, which is run for the high school students, we have the students meet with a justice at noon, and everyone in the courtroom is cordially invited to do that, including and especially the Paralegal Club of Northwest Technical College in De Pere. So we hope you'll stay for the noon presentation. I say noon, approximately noon. And the justice who will make the presentation today is Justice Wilcox, who, as I said, is seated to my left. With those introductions made, I'll call our next case, 01-2157-D, in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against John Wadul, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John Wadul.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, my name is John Waduli. I am the respondent in this action and, of course, the appellant. I'd first like to say that this case, I will admit, has a long history. This is my first opportunity to address this court, although I have filed two petitions for certiorari in this, in the related underlying cases. But this is the first time I've had to address your court. Let me first say that this case, one of the big issues in this case was that I actually sued another attorney. I don't relish suing another attorney. That is what happened. That created a myriad of issues, which I would contend are rather novel issues and issues which the Supreme Court of this state has not had an opportunity to address in a business context where an attorney acts as a closing agent and also an attorney for a bank. That is to say, to what extent does the closing attorney have duties to non-clients who are parties to a business transaction? That issue in many ways was dealt with by the Supreme Court of Idaho in the case which I cite in my brief, which is All American Realty, Inc. versus Sweet at 687 Pacific Reporter, 2nd, 1356. I would encourage your reading of that case. That is a 1984 case. In that case, an attorney acted as a closing agent. The real estate broker did not get paid. The issue before the Idaho Supreme Court was, well, so what? Doesn't an attorney owe a duty to its client and no duty to non-clients? The court struggled with that. They concluded in three plurality opinions as they struggled with that issue that to do so, that there was a duty running to the non-client party to the transaction, and that duty, and that the breach of that duty constituted conversion. That is my case. That is much of my case. In that particular case, the real estate broker didn't show up at the closing either. The failure to appear at the closing did not drive a waiver argument. It did not drive an estoppel argument. It did not get away from the basic issue before you even consider who John Wadooley is or what he may have done or who Larry Ormson is or who Tim Ormson is there a duty that a lawyer has to a non-client? And I would suggest to you that as I get older, I've been around a while, and I grew up in the real estate business. This is all in part of the record in this case as well as in the other case. I would encourage you to read the transcripts in this case if you have not. And I know limited resources and whatnot, but this is important. It's not just important to me. It's important to the development of the law in this regard. The real estate business, when I got in that, it was caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. That has grown and changed as the regulators have attempted to try to determine just what duties does a real estate broker to have to someone who isn't his client, to someone who isn't a party to that transaction. You're going to see that happen in the law business. Mark my words. Mark my words. And this is a good case for it. It's a good case for it. An attorney should not be able to stand behind the shield of the fact that he's an attorney. He or she is an attorney. That's wrong. It sends the wrong image to the public, and we're going to get there. And that's what the Idaho court struggled with, and that's what happened to me because I got involved in a hornet's nest down in Dane County. And there was a lot of resistance to suing an attorney and suing a bank. Well, I will tell you this. In the All-American Realty case, they only joined the attorney. They didn't join the principal, who happened to be the Farmers Home Loan Administration, or the seller. And the issue there was not whether or not you should join the attorney, but whether you had to join the bank too. I sued the bank. I sued the attorney. I sued them for conversion. I found case law to support my position. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has not addressed this issue, although tangentially we have dealt, I know, in the Green Springs case, for example, with what duties does a lawyer have to a third party? Well, certainly that case is read to suggest that intentional misconduct is actionable by third parties. And hence conversion. Hence,
I want to get to this case. And one of the things that perplexes me is that Judge Calloway found that you had frivolously and maliciously filed false and inaccurate information in the lawsuit. That finding was appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals sustained that finding in an opinion issued on April 12th of 2000. The Court of Appeals, in part, said that the trial court's finding that you had threatened Merg and Royal Plastics proceeding, the finding that it was maliciously done, is not clearly erroneous and supports the trial court's inferences of malicious intent. The referee here did not find maliciousness. My question to you is, does issue preclusion arise since the trial court and the Court of Appeals both concluded that the record supported malicious intent?
I will respond to that, and I think it may take a moment. First of all, just strictly looking at issue preclusion, and I don't want to hide behind the burden of proof, but the burden of proof is higher in a disciplinary proceeding. I will also say this, that the fatal error, and that is where my petitions for review address this issue, was the finding of malicious was based upon because there was a frivolous case. I can assure you that I can confirm that there is no frivolous case. There's an FBI report that confirms the validity of the note and the security agreement in this case. That's a prima facie case of secured creditor status. I have an FBI report. No one's talking about that. It's irrefutable evidence that the loan documents that I filed were valid. I always thought they were, and they are. And they are. As to evidence which was tainted, there's two areas of evidence. One is the testimony of a Paul Martin. Paul Martin when we were looking for the loan documents, supplied an affidavit that says he mailed a file to Donna Merg. On the very same day, Donna Merg, we exchange affidavits at the hearing. I don't see hers. She doesn't see mine. She said she never has any possession of any documents belonging to OFS. Neither one of us could have possibly known what the other one was saying. Now we're in a real quandary. Ed Hannon takes Paul Martin's deposition. I take Paul Martin's deposition. A year and a half later, 2.5 years later, Paul Martin says, I was bribed to make up that story. Now you've got two huge issues in front of you. One, it's moot because whatever the third-party witnesses said, A, are moot because the loan documents have been located, so we're no longer looking for the loan documents. And so the issue's moot, and I couldn't possibly have known about that. And the second thing is I withdrew any tainted evidence the moment it was established that it was tainted, period. That Paul Martin evidence was removed. I also filed a motion in limine, to exclude all Paul Martin evidence. That's not a lawyer continuing a case on false evidence. It's clearly erroneous to find that I did. I filed a motion in limine to exclude it from that case. The same thing with the Dave Graham's letter. There was a letter. It was on Dave Graham's stationery. It was provided to me. I filed it. Dave Graham's filed an affidavit saying, I deny signing it. I deny authoring it. I am advised by Larry Armson that it was probably Jim Ligodny, who was his lawyer, who was operating out of Dave Graham's office, who prepared that letter and sent that letter. Okay? So just to say I didn't sign it and I didn't write it isn't good enough. So I specifically informed the DeChambeau court that I am standing on that information right now that it might be Jim Ligodny who signed that letter, and that the fact that Dave Graham said, well, I didn't sign it, is just a half-truth. I subpoena Dave Graham's for deposition. My subpoenas are ignored by my opposing counsel. They're called worthless pieces of paper. I'm trying to do discovery to find out what's going on. They're worthless pieces of paper because they say there was a protective order issued by Judge DeChambeau on March 9th of 1995. However, on March 17th of 1995, the original loan documents were filed. And on March 28th of 1995, I got a letter from Judge DeChambeau stating I can proceed. Now, if I can proceed to do discovery, but I'm blocked from discovery, and I think I'm getting a professional defense job here, and a defense that is just trying to hide something, I state my basis for why I filed it. When I got to the hearing on June 26, 1995, I was provided for the first time with some information from James Ligodny that's denied signing it. I promptly withdrew that letter. I never stood on that letter again. And so my obligation is if I find that evidence that comes from a third party is tainted, I withdraw that evidence. I did that. I did not stand on that evidence, and no one can suggest that I did, but they continue to do so. I did not file false evidence. Any evidence that I found that was false, that became tainted, I promptly withdrew.
You're referring to the letter purportedly from a David Graham?
Yes, I am, sir.
Where did it come from, since it didn't come from Mr. Graham's, but it was signed by a Mr. Graham?
That letter was addressed to Larry Armson, if I remember correctly. It was produced to me by Larry Armson, and it was produced to me in March, on about March 13th, 12th or 13th of 1995. That is when that letter was produced to me.
Mr. Dooley, you're charged with knowingly advancing a factual position without a basis for doing so in violation of 23.182, that is, that it's a frivolous action. And very succinctly, and there are four charges here.
Yes, ma'am.
Very succinctly, if you can. What is your defense to that charge?
That the evidence supporting my case, which is the note which has been proven indisputably, the security agreement, which has been proven indisputably, and my exhibit, which had copies of canceled checks showing over $700,000 of loans from Tim Ormson to Northern Plastics, Inc., was submitted to support secured creditor status. I don't want to interrupt you.
Well, I interrupted you, but I'm going to do that. As I understand it, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals concluded that using an objective standard that you did engage in frivolous activities. Is that right?
I think that they articulated their basis, and they said that the reason that they for their findings is because I filed a frivolous case. And I'm trying to tell you, Your Honor, that I have evidence which a reviewing court has the ability to look at. You can look at documentary evidence as
did
a matter of law.
Did the trial court and Court of Appeals have that evidence, too?
The trial court and the Court of Appeals, neither of them considered the FBI report, and neither of them considered the evidence supporting the secured creditor status.
They have it in their records?
I believe they did.
Okay. All right. Justice Wilcox.
Was it, in other words, was it part of, it was part of the record is what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. But it was not considered. It was, in fact, Judge Callaway, and this is in the petition for review in 2616, in 99-2616, specifically stated that his assumptions were, one, that Judge Bartel had found the case frivolous and that all he was supposed to do was impose sanctions. That's wrong. Two, that he did not consider the documentary evidence, but he gave it to the Court of Appeals. Now, the Court of Appeals didn't consider it, and so here I am.
Mr. Wadooley, I'm going to ask you, but I'm also going to ask Mr. Crone this question. It's my understanding that for a trial court and in review, a court of appeals, a determination about frivolous is done on an objective standard, namely, would a reasonable lawyer know or believe that this matter has no basis in fact or law. My understanding on the basis of the Lauer case, which is not cited by either one of you, that for a determination in a OLR complaint on discipline, the standard is subjective. Namely, did you know? And of course...
Subjective, did you say?
Objective, yes. And that obviously what you say is used and considered by a court as to what your subjective view is, but the court looks at the entire thing to determine whether it's credible, plausible, that you did not subjectively know or believe. That doesn't appear to be your defense here, though.
My defense is that as a matter of law, I had a non-frivolous case. There is no question.
Objectively or subjectively?
Yeah, that doesn't matter. It's clearly... Oh, and I will say this. And that's why I started off with whether there's novel issues of law. Hey, you sue a lawyer and a bank. And they aren't your client's client. You've got a problem here. Now you're stepping into an area that is not well defined. And so, do I have a good faith argument? In other words, anything that I had, I either have a good faith argument in fact and law, or I have a good faith argument for an extension or development of that law in that area. And that's what I had from day one in this case. And that determination of whether or not I have a case as a matter of law, whether I have documentary evidence as a matter of law, and whether or not I had a good faith position for the development or extension of law is a question of law.
Counsel, count two, Mr. Wadooley, dealt with that you took action on behalf of a client when it was obvious that such action would serve merely to harass or maliciously injure another in violation of 20:3.1A3. And I gather, if I'm correct, that the referee did not think that charge was proved.
Right. The referee found it was not malicious. True.
All right. So we can go on to count three.
Yes.
Wadooley had a conflict of interest in simultaneously representing two clients and himself in violation of SCR 20:1.7B.
I was charged with that, yes.
Yes. And your response to that?
My response is there was no directly adverse position, and I can prove that. The rule is a lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation of that client will be directly adverse to another client. And now someone has to determine whether or not what I did was directly adverse to my client. The argument is, I guess their argument is that I said something against the interests of my client. I didn't say anything against the position of my client.
Well, you did say, didn't you? Didn't you say that the interests of your client, Stauffacher, were secondary to the interests of your client, Ormsen?
What I said was that my client pointed out...
Which client?
David Stauffacher pointed out to the court that he was paid the wrong amount. I had discussions with David Stauffacher. I think that it's important...
In essence, as I understand it, you were representing both. You were on a monthly retainer from Stauffacher...
I represented both clients. I do not deny that.
And okay, so, but you were engaged in a litigation in which they were essentially arguing for the same pot of money.
No, that is not true. That is not true. There was a case against Donna Murg. And what would have happened, the only risk, which I discussed with David Stauffacher is, and this is, to me, this is a business decision of what position a client wants to take. I didn't take a position adverse to Mr. Stauffacher. I explained to him the possible risk. And the possible risk is that Donna Murg may someday sue David Stauffacher because she paid him a different amount of the letter.
Well, did you or did you not make an argument to Judge Calloway that Stauffacher had paid $5,000 too much?
That Stauffacher was paid $5,000 too much, and I had that approved by my client. That was my client's position. I did not take a position adverse to my client. He makes the decision as to what's in his best interests. I made an argument consistent with my client's position. All too often, we as lawyers stick our nose where it doesn't belong and make business decisions for our clients. And that is wrong. And I've come to learn that that is wrong. You assess the client his risks. You let him make his own decisions. And that's what I did. And that's the argument I made.
Did the client consent in writing after consultation as provided for in 20.1.7?
I read you from 20:1.7. And what I'm suggesting to you is that I admit that there was no written consent to this argument, but I'm suggesting to you that my interpretation of this statute, and I don't know how you interpret it any other way, is I make the argument that my client consents to. I haven't made an argument directly adverse to my client. And that I don't know any other way to read this.
So it's your position, number one, the lawyer reasonably believes the representation will not be adversely affected.
It was not.
And the client consents in writing after consultation. You believe you fulfill both of those?
No, I'm saying under number one, I did not. Under number one, there is no requirement that of a written consent if there is no directly adverse representation, and there was none. There was none. I did not have a written requirement. I did not. Or, I'll tell you what, if I do, it's a surprise. It's a big surprise under those circumstances that my client can't decide what's adverse to him or not. A man who owns a hotel company who's a more savvy businessman than anyone in this room. and a guy I've known for 20 years can't decide what's in his best interest or not? It's my job? No way. No way. No. No. Mm-mm. I do want to speak. Oh, my warning light is on.
You have approximately 4 to 5 minutes left. You will also have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Wadooley.
All right. Just see if there's anything else I want to add. I think that the basic legal premise that I was up against was wrong, and that is an error of law which I've demonstrated to this court. Judge Calloway, Ed Hannon, Donna Merg, and the bank were under the basic assumption that Tim Wormson could be forced to bear all shortfalls at that closing. That is not true under the law. It is not true under the law. And I've stated that in my brief and articulated that. I am a victim of a wrong legal premise from the very beginning of this case. I have evidence that there was a timely revocation. It was for distribution of the proceeds. That's an extremely crucial point, is that objections were made, disputes were raised prior to final distribution of the proceeds. I have all kinds of evidence supporting that, and that is the law. It is conversion to misapply and rearrange proceeds under 409, 504, and 507. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Mr. Wadooley, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Robert G. Crone, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulations. Mr. Crone.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'm Robert Crone, law firm of Rothy and Crone. I appear on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Mr. Crone, you might want to raise the lectern, and there is a button on your left. On the left, right on the lectern, right, which will raise it if you press it.
I'm sure I want to spend my time doing this if I don't have to.
Well, perhaps the marshal could help you for a moment, and then we will proceed. It might be that it's not. There it is. Good. See, she didn't even have to touch it.
One of the courses I didn't take in law school, right. I might add.
Well, she's gotten several weeks of training.
Thank you. May it again please the Court. Again, I'm Robert Crone. I appear on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. As the Court knows, this is a case that principally deals with an attorney here, Mr. Wadooley, who, in our view, commenced and continued a clearly frivolous case over a long period of time in a rather vindictive way against an attorney and a bank. He is not a victim of the conduct of the bank or the existence of the bank or the attorney. He is a victim of his own practices. It is our view that, in addition, Mr. Wadooley was involved in some multiple representations at times, involving conflicts of interest, and failed to research or otherwise prepare this case in a way, if he had done that, would have discovered that it was frivolous, and it continued to be frivolous as it went on. In fact, it got worse with an unraveling of some rather bizarre, almost surreal events in this case.
Was Mrs. This attorney, Merg, was she represented during the course of this, or did she represent herself?
No, she's represented by attorney Ed Hannon, who appeared for her in this case, as well as the bank.
Yeah, is there anything in the record that would indicate the amount of attorney fees that she incurred?
Oh, there is. That is in the record, and it was significant and certainly considered as a part of Judge Calloway's decision.
How much?
I hesitate to quote that. I can perhaps find it for you later, but it was very significant. Referee Hero's decision was really fact-driven. It is not clearly erroneous, as this Court's standards would require for this appeal to be successful. It's difficult to track some of the facts in this case, and I'm hesitant to do that because it seems, but on the other hand, Mr. Wadooley seems to be trying to supplement the record here and, in effect, trying to retry the case on the merits of the case. But what happened here all surrounds the events of a closing at the Royal Bank back in December of 92. Northern Plastics was in default. They were owned by Larry Ormson, and they surrendered their assets, and Donna Merg, the attorney for the bank, provided notices under the UCC and UCC statements and so on to the various creditors who appeared at this closing. And Ormson Financial Services, coincidentally owned by Tim Ormson, brother of Larry Ormson, was a junior lien holder. They returned a statement that was left blank, the amount of money that was to go to them. The closing was held. OFS was represented by Larry Ormson, not Tim Ormson, the principal, but Larry Ormson, the owner of Northern Plastics, appeared with authority to act. And, in fact, after some negotiations, did accept $44,000, which was paid sometime later after unrelated litigation was resolved. What followed was a lawsuit some 2 years later, almost to the day, on December 15 of 94 in Dane County Court, brought by Mr. Tim Ormson, and Mr. Waduli was his attorney, suing both Merg and the bank, claiming that, in fact, Ormson did not get the appropriate amount of money. Instead of $44,000, it should have been $245,000 or up to that amount of money. The lawsuits that were set forth in the complaint were a breach of trust, intentional misrepresentation, conversion, unjust enrichment, negligence, and so forth. From the start, members of the court, this case had no merit because Donna Merg represented the Royal Bank. Her duties and obligations were to her client. She was not a trustee or a fiduciary or had any kind of fiduciary relationship to any of these creditors, all of whom appeared at this closing, some represented, some unrepresented, and agreed to the proceeds that were to be distributed. So there is simply no fiduciary duty running from Donna Merg, attorney for the bank, to one of the junior lien holders. As far as conversion is concerned, Larry Ormson had apparent authority in writing at the time of this closing to act on behalf of his brother, on behalf of OFS. OFS never declared to Donna Merg. She never knew what the amount was that was to go to OFS until that amount was decided at the closing.
Has either of the Mr. Ormsons disputed that Timothy had the right to represent his brother?
Well, they've disputed it after the fact, Justice Babich, because at the answer depends upon when. They since have argued that they sent a letter rescinding. There is an argument that Larry had sent a letter rescinding authority to act. Again, a fact question. Ms. Merck said no such letter was sent. A purported letter was produced at this disciplinary case dated December 21, which is 3 days after the closing. The closing occurred on the 18th, and the checks were, that which was a Friday, and the checks were cut and sent out on the 21st. So there is a letter by Larry's brother, Tim, rescinding the authority, but that was a disputed fact.
Was that the letter that disappeared from the files?
No.
Something disappeared from the files in the Dane County Clerk's.
What disappeared from the files was the what was contended to be the original security documents that were produced by Mr. Waduli through his client. Those documents, I should point out that one of the concerns of the defense here was that this was a claim based upon a commercial transaction. You need paper to establish a commercial transaction. You need a note, a security agreement, and so forth. That was not attached to the complaint. And in the early discovery phases, a demand immediately was made by Mr. Hannon on behalf of Ms. Berg and the bank, show us the papers. Give us the papers. And the response from Mr. Waduli was a kind of a floating response. It was very inconclusive. Well, it's not material to the case. His response was, you already have the papers. His suggestion was to Ms. Merg, you already have these papers. I'm not going to produce them. Well, that raised a great level of suspicion on behalf of the defense. And then ultimately, an appearance was before Judge DeChambeau, and a motion was made for a protective order, essentially to stay all proceedings until the papers were produced upon which this lawsuit was founded. And Judge DeChambeau agreed and issued such a protective order. And then, lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, what happens was one of the Ormsons, I'm forgetting which one now, I think it was Tim Ormson, declared, well, I found the papers. They were behind a file cabinet at my home, and then filed them ultimately and presented them to the court. They were the subject of some scrutiny by Bonnie Schwid, and also by the handwriting by the FBI. The FBI got involved coincidentally because of some investigation of the Ormsons in a federal case, got involved in looking at some commercial paper. But to answer your question, those are the documents that then got into the court file or filed and then mysteriously were missing at some point in time, and nobody has an explanation.
Was this after the questions were raised with respect to forgeries, et cetera?
Yes. There were questions raised about forgeries at or about the same time because this one affidavit was withdrawn shortly after it was put in the record, and that was after those questions were raised. In any event, the conversion theory, as I indicated, had no merit to begin with because the check had been accepted, the closing statements had been signed by Mr. Ormson at the closing, approving of the closing. The check had ultimately, for $44,000, had been received, endorsed, accepted. I addressed the rescission issue that was raised later. And then as the lawsuit unraveled in the Dane County Court, there was this, as I said, surreal series of events here that are difficult to explain, but the discovery requests were made for the documentation, and then the protective order was entered, and then the plaintiff produces a Paul Martin affidavit saying that, in effect, that Donna Merg has these documents. Donna Merg, of course, denied this. The protective order was entered. Shortly thereafter, the affidavit was entered by Tim Ormson that he found the documents. Then we have this rather strange letter from David Grams that also surfaced right after the protective order was entered. David Grams, who was the owner of Royal Bank, a bank not to be confused with Royal Plastics, owner of Royal Plastics, not to be confused with Royal Bank, as I just confused them. In any event, he signs a letter of December 7, 92, and they offer that, indicating again that that letter suggests a conversation with Ms. Merg where there was a confirmation that $185,000 was owed. This was a letter that was the product of fraud and the product as a result of a bribe that was discovered some years later, actually. That was a false letter.
Counsel, Attorney Wadooley advances the position contrary to the referee. Referee, as I recall, recommended, for a sanction of
3 months.
3 months.
Right.
And Attorney Wadooley, of course, takes the position that there's no violation and therefore no discipline. Previously, you had advanced a 6-month, if I recall, suspension.
Correct.
What is your position currently? And if it is different than the referee, what's the rationale?
Well, the referee did determine that this was a frivolous action that was commenced and continued as a frivolous action with no legitimate basis, but didn't go so far as to say it was malicious under sub 3 of that particular provision. We disagreed with that. We think that the conclusion of maliciousness could well have been drawn by the referee as it had been drawn by Judge Calloway based upon the totality of the circumstances. So, but we also understand that the standard of knowingly perpetuating a frivolous lawsuit is perhaps different and lower than the higher standard of maliciously doing these sorts of things for the purpose of damaging or injuring somebody. Recognizing that, we respect the decision of the referee. We disagree with it. We think that the 6-month suspension order, or suggestion, the recommendation we made is still appropriate.
Counsel.
Based on all the circumstances, whether or not the maliciousness is even in the case. And I think it is.
I'm not sure you answered Justice Bradley's question. What is your stance now with respect to recommendation? Does it remain 6 months?
6 months.
Okay. Obviously, my questions implicate problems that I have in my mind with respect to theft of documents, forgeries of documents, et cetera. Has this matter ever been referred to criminal action or investigation?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. Mr. Hannon is reminding me that apparently it was. He was involved with it long before I got involved. Apparently it was.
But you don't know what the outcome
was? I do not know what the outcome was.
Maybe we can ask Mr. Aduli. All right. You may proceed.
So I don't think that there's any question about the frivolity of this case. The determination was made by Judge Calloway, but we did not rest upon Judge Calloway's determination in terms of our presentation. Under the case cited by the Chief Justice, we felt it was important because of the different standards and tests for a disciplinary case to proceed with all the evidence and essentially to retry the case, which we did. And the referee's decision is based upon his review of this case. And while he did take notice of Judge Calloway's findings and determinations, he did not feel compelled to be bound by them. And it was a piece of evidence more than anything else.
Do you argue the subjective rather than the objective standard and call that to the attention of the referee? And the reason I ask is because I looked for that in the findings.
Yes.
And don't find it. I only find a finding number 24. The words frivolous and malicious have been the subject of discussion, definition, and interpretation by our courts, but remain subjective. I don't know if that means subjective to the referee or subjective to Mr. Aduli. And then he asks some questions, and he says the referee finds that a well-prepared attorney, now we look as if it's objective, not clouded by his contingent fee arrangement with a client who would pervert the facts, would recognize the frivolity of his pursuit. Don't find a finding Mr. Aduli subjectively.
Well, I'm not sure.
Understood and knew. Or maybe you don't think that's required by Lauer.
I'm not so sure that's required, and I think if you read that decision, it seems to cover both bases. And in presenting this case, I was fact-driven, and we talked about Mr. Wadooley's conduct, Mr. Wadooley's state of mind. We were not presenting this case in terms of what the hypothetical reasonable lawyer would do. It all was directed to Mr. Wadooley and what he did. So having said that, I interpreted the decision, although it contains some general comments about what a reasonable lawyer would do, I interpreted that decision to refer clearly to the more subjective test required under the disciplinary standards dealing with Wadooley's conduct.
What language do you point to rely on that premise?
Well, I think the Chief Justice read the pertinent language. On paragraph 24 of the referee's decision, and then the beginning portions of that, when he talks about the concepts of frivolous and malicious and what they mean to him, I would admit that it's not too clear whether that's a esoteric discussion of these terms or whether he's referring to Mr. Wadooley. But then he goes on to say, was the respondent frivolous in pursuing the matter of Tim Ormson versus Merg, or was he a zealot on a crusade? Now, that seems to me to suggest he's pointing towards Mr. The conduct of Mr. Wadooley as opposed to some hypothetical lawyer. And the body, the rest of the decision, and all of the record is directed in that towards that standard in the case. Now, as far as the legal representation, there were a number of conflicts. The referee just found one, and that is, as Justice Babbage pointed out, that Mr. Wadooley is contending at the Dayton County court level that, in fact, this was a commercially unreasonable closing and that his client got shorted. In fact, at the same time, he had Mr. Stauffacher as a client paying $12,500 a month, who also had an interest in the proceeds of Northern Plastics. And there's no indication that there's any consent, written or otherwise, to his taking a position that, in fact, benefits one client and does nothing on behalf of another. And then in the course of that particular case, in front of Judge Calloway, he specifically says that Stauffacher got too much. He got $5,000 too much. Well, there's a limited pot here to distribute, and he's got two clients, and it seems to me a clear conflict. Now, he can say now, well, he had permission from his client to do that, but there's nothing in writing and there's nothing in the record that supports that assertion on his part. Likewise, there is another matter that's set forth in the record concerning another case where he is representing both Stauffacher and Ormson at the same time.
Ron, I'd like to go back just a moment again to the costs incurred by Attorney Merg, because at least as far as I can tell, there's been no requirement, no request for costs to be assessed against Mr. Wadooley.
Well, in the in answer to your previous question, when we started this argument, I'm told that the costs or attorney's fees are approximately $150,000, in excess of that.
And did, now, did and what did the referee do with anything with that, if anything?
He didn't do anything with that. The referee was mindful of Judge Calloway's decision, which did deal with sanctions. And Judge Calloway, in an order for judgment, which is an exhibit here, ordered a payment of $102,000 for sanctions together with interest against the various parties, that is, Tim Ormson and Wadooley. That was
been satisfied?
That was ultimately amended so that a certain amount applied to Ormson and a certain amount applied to Wadooley, roughly $70,000, $75,000 each, and to my knowledge, it has not been satisfied.
Thank you.
Lastly, there is one other count that the OLR brought and I think was established and is a finding that is not clearly erroneous, and that relates to the general question of competency. This is a case that had there been a review of Hornbook law dealing with accord and satisfaction, waiver and estoppel, Mr. Wadooley would have learned that, in fact, that there was no basis from this lawsuit for this lawsuit from the get-go. This is a case where his client authorized his brother to go to a closing, and they accepted a sum certain that had been discussed, agreed to, a closing statement had been signed, and they endorsed the check, they got the money, and there appeared to have been no preliminary research done on those issues that's reflected in this record before this lawsuit was started. And that was really fundamental to the very cause of action that was being asserted here. Now, indeed, those issues were briefed later when this matter got to the appellate level. But by then it was too late. And that was the end of the story in terms of the research done. There really was limited research, limited factual legal documentation provided in this record as to why this lawsuit was commenced and what the support for the lawsuit was in the first instance. Now, in terms of sanction, as has been pointed out, the OLR did recommend 6 months. The referee found 3 months. I simply want to point out to the court that this was a proceeding that lasted close to 8 years. This was a proceeding that, in Judge Calloway's opinion, and let me say that he does not mince his words, talked in terms of Mr. Wadooley knowingly, willfully, intentionally, viciously, and maliciously commencing, using, and continuing this action against Donna Merg and Royal Bank. Those were his findings of fact. And this was a very vengeful public attack on a good lawyer. a lawyer who has got a sound reputation in front of this court and in all of the courts of Wisconsin. And it's a case that has wound its way through the Dane County system involving three judges, through the appellate system, and it's been quite literally a monumental waste of time and resources for the courts and for the litigants, and a very costly defense. But Mr. Wadooley, like the proverbial pit bull, would simply not let go of this case and still does not want to let go of this case and still is trying to expand this record to argue his positions on the merits that have already been decided. So we believe that the factual determinations of the referee were independent of what Judge Callaway did, although quite similar in terms of net result, and they are not clearly erroneous. And
Counsel, I want to focus on the what you just said, that Attorney Wadooley won't let go and he's still advancing the underlying premise. The standard, as the Chief noted, is the subjective standard. In the Lauer case, the Court wrote, that is, whether the attorney in fact knew the claim he was advancing was unwarranted under existing law and could not be supported by a good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of existing law. Do you, that seems to be inconsistent with what I just heard you say, that, you know, he's still taking that issue and running with it. Do you believe that the referee's findings and conclusions support that he, in fact, knew the claim he was advancing was unwarranted under existing law and could not be supported by a good faith argument for an extension?
Yes. Yes. That's what the referee found. That's what the provision that he found was violated requires, knowingly. However, knowingly, as defined in the Supreme Court rules, is not absolutely knowing something. It can be inferred from circumstances. That's one of the qualifying bits of language dealing with the definition of knowingly. So, yes, we believe that is the requirement under this rule. We believe that was what the referee found. We believe that was what was proven.
Is it knowingly only, or should have known? Does that language bring in the objective then?
Well, I can only read the rule, and the rule says knowingly, and I think that's pretty much defined by what was done and can be inferred from the circumstances of what was done. Knowingly advancing a factual position unless there is a basis for doing so that is not frivolous, and knowingly can be inferred from the circumstances under the definition. So. I think that was established here. I don't know if that answers your specific question.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have no further argument. Unless there are other questions, I've completed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Wadooley.
Thank you. First, let me say that regarding the, sort of work backwards here, the affirmative defenses of waiver, estoppel, and accord and satisfaction, those were all raised, and unlike what my friend Mr. Crone has stated, they were briefed thoroughly in the circuit court. There's a well-written opinion by Justice Angela Bartel in this case, dated February 10th, 1997. It is an exhibit in this proceeding, as it was in the court below, denying summary judgment, looking at my claims, determining whether I stated claims, looking at the evidence, determining whether the prima facie defenses which they tried to raise were defeated, and they all were, and summary judgment was denied. I'm not asserting that in all instances that summary judgment is denied, that there cannot be a frivolous case. I'm not suggesting that, because I know there's law that cuts the other way. However, you do have to look at what the issue is, and he can't get up here and say that Hornbook law should have told Wadooley there's no waiver or that there's an accord and satisfaction. That's not true. That's not true. You can't have a conversion case and raise a defense of accord and satisfaction. I've cited the Continental Assurance case. It's not a defense to an intentional tort case. You can't have intentional conduct and walk in and argue equitable defenses like waiver and estoppel. It can't be done. It can't be done. It's not that simple. It's not that simple. Now, the disappearing documents in Dane County, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that because I don't know where those documents are, and it bothers me that they're gone. Because those documents are legit, and the FBI had those documents. Those documents were transmitted in December of 1995 to the FBI to be looked at. They were looked at. They were tested. They were found to be valid. They were given back to the Dane County Circuit Court. I didn't have the FBI results, but I strongly suspect that my opposing, well, I better be careful I say this because I don't want to speculate, but some people knew what that FBI report said, that those loan documents were legitimate.
Is a copy of that FBI report here?
It is an exhibit to my appendix. It unquestionably says that the commercial inks used in the three pens, three different pens signed by three different people to execute the note and the security agreement, were commercially available inks in at the time of the date, the purported dates of the documents.
Well, that doesn't tell us a whole lot, does it?
That tells me a lot because I went to Grant Johnson, the of the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was given that report by Grant Johnson. He told me, I know this may be hearsay, but I believe it's in the record in front of Harrell. What I learned from Grant Johnson was that that's how you date documents. You ink date test them in the United States government crime lab, the FBI crime lab. I have that irrefutable evidence in my favor. And some people knew that that existed. And now those loan documents, after they were transmitted back to the Dane County Circuit Court, after I looked at them with Ed Hannon and Judge Bartell on October 16th of 1997, somehow mysteriously disappeared from that file. I have no reason to take those documents from that file. Somebody did, and those documents are gone, and it's very disturbing. This case was referred to the Dane County District Attorney's Office on November 25th, 1998. I supplied much documents to Diane Nix, who was the DA at the time, and I certainly would be willing to cooperate in that regard. I didn't start this sanctions hunt. I will tell you that if you've ever been accused of 200 things you didn't do, and now I'm down to three, I've disproven every one. Well, people have agreed with me on 197 counts, if you will, that Judge Calloway accused me of. And it's very interesting. Those findings of Judge Calloway are loaded against me. They're loaded against me. I specifically, on September 11th, my September 11th was September 11th, 1998, when I got sanctioned, and I asked Judge Calloway, did this court find that I knew that Paul Martin was lying? And you can look in the transcript. It's in the record. It's in all these records of September 11th, 1998. He said, I don't have to find that. You've got a burden, a heavy responsibility to find out the truth. Well, that's not a finding that I filed false evidence, and yet the proposed findings that Ed Hannon, 300 findings that weren't proven, are signed by Judge Calloway. And now those findings are going to stick to me?
Well, no, have you satisfied the judgment that Judge Calloway?
I have not satisfied the judgment, nor am I able.
What was that judgment?
Nor am I able to.
How about it was against you and who?
There were several judgments. They are severed. I have a judgment against me for approximately $90,000 plus interest since 1998. I am not able to pay it. It shouldn't be there.
Are you unable or unwilling?
I am unable. And I will tell you this, my time's up. I've lost a lot more in this case than anyone else. And I never got a dime. And I didn't do a thing wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wadooly, and thank you, Mr. Crone. That completes the argument in 01-2157D in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against John Wadooly, attorney at law. That ends the hearing. The court is in recess till 1:45. The students may remain here, and anyone else who wishes to participate may remain, and Justice Wilcox will be back in a few moments.
Mr. Crone? Yes, sir.